Disney Plus. Gruwelijke spanning in het allerlaatste seizoen van The Walking Dead.
They want stuff.
Ijzingwekkende sensatie in de veelbelovende nieuwe serie Why the Last Man.
In one day, half of our world gone.
En een flinke portie humor met Selena Gomez in Only Murders in the Building.
I wanna break into a dead guy's apartment.
Stream nu exclusief op Disney Plus.
Sounds like an afternoon.
You are listening to The Raelish Report. Here's your host, John Friend.
Hello, John.
All right, folks. Welcome back to another edition of The Raelish Report. I am your host, John Friend. Today, I have a very special guest. Tan Stoffel from Age of Treason is joining me on the line. Tan Stoffel is one of the most knowledgeable and insightful commentators in the pro-white independent media today, particularly when it comes to the Jewish question, or more accurately, the Jewish problem, a topic we will be discussing at length today. So, Tan Stoffel, welcome to The Raelish Report. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me, John. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Yeah, and for people that aren't familiar with your work, I'm going to post a link to a radio program that you did where you kind of go through your background and how you awoke to some of these issues and how you started your website and your radio program and whatnot. But for now, can you just tell people the URL to your website and any other details you want to give out about your website?
I think if you just search for Age of Treason, you'll find my site. It's probably ranked high enough that you'll see it's age-of-treason.com, and it's easy to find.
Okay, and of course I'll have a link directly to your site when I post this program, and as I mentioned, a link to a radio program where you kind of talk about your background and whatnot. So anyways, let's just go ahead and jump right into the discussion, and let's start off by could you just explain to our audience how you sort of woke up to the Jewish problem?
Well, it started by waking up to race first. I went through most of my life pretending that race isn't important and doesn't exist. And looking back on it, in many ways, I showed the proper instincts that I knew certain places and certain things were not safe and were not good. But I didn't, like most white people, I basically didn't think of myself as white or having interests as a white person. And I eventually, after one particular straw broke the camel's back, I realized and accepted that I was white and that whites are under attack as a race, and that I was part of that, whether I wanted to be part of it or not. And to put it in terms that I later realized, racist is a code word for white, basically. What I saw, and I think what the straws that broke the camel's back ultimately, were the double standards on race, the hypocrisy, the identity politics. And I didn't understand this until later either, that identity politics as it exists now is, as it has always existed, as it was constructed, is inherently anti-white. It's the anti-white premise of it is built in. It's not about all people organizing by race to advocate for their interests as a race or as a group. It's all groups except whites being allowed and even encouraged to organize racially, and Jews first and foremost of that. And the way that I was forced to confront the Jews was, once I realized that race was important, I realized that the attack on the white race was coming mainly from Jews, that Jews were the most vocal, the most vitriolic attackers of whites.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so that's how it happened.
Very interesting. Yeah, and you made the point, you were sort of talking about how you were kind of deracinated. You didn't really think in racial terms prior to your racial awakening. And I think that's really how the vast majority of white people are, certainly in America, but really probably even in Europe at this point. I mean,
yeah, and it's unnatural too. It's not just that we are sort of naturally not interested in race. It's actually propagandized to us that way. We're indoctrinated with this idea that whites specifically thinking in terms of race is wrong. It's evil, even. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, you hear the leftists and the anti-whites going on and on and on about how there's still white supremacy in America, and if you look at Congress, it's all white people. And yeah, that is true to a certain extent, but these white people in Congress and these white people controlling our government, which is, you know, becoming increasingly non-white, but the white people that are in government and in the media and whatnot, they do not think of themselves as white. They are not out there acting in the best interests of whites. They are totally deracinated and in many cases are working for the racial interests of other groups.
Yeah, that's the dishonesty you're pointing out of that argument that we live in a white supremacist system because there's whites in control of the universities. Whites are the have been every president up until Obama. Whites run the banks. Whites run Hollywood. It's really disingenuous because even the whites that are involved in those things don't think of themselves as white. Don't have a positive identity as a white, or if they do, they keep it to themselves. They know that they have to keep it to themselves, or they'll lose their position in any of those places.
Absolutely. Now, getting back to the Jewish problem, so you said that you sort of woke up to race first, and then you recognized the Jews as really the primary adversaries of the white race, and I mean, there's a long history of this that we can talk more about. But I guess just generally speaking, how would you describe the Jewish problem or the Jewish question? I think the Jewish problem is a much more accurate, description of this issue that, you know, this issue with Jews that, you know, we see all across the world today, especially in America. But like, how would you describe the Jewish problem to an average person? What are the most important points that people need to understand when it comes to this issue?
Right. Well, it depends where they're starting from. If they're starting from zero, where I traced my start from, that they're deracinated, you have to talk to them about race, and you have to get them to see this realization that we're under attack as a race, as a group, and that just because you're acting like it doesn't matter to you, that's not going to protect you. You're not going to be safe because of that. But once you get somebody to say, okay, race does matter, it's important, and I'm white and I'm going to do something about it, then you need to point out the Jews to them. It doesn't come automatically to most people. In fact, a lot of people will try to pretend, you know, continue the pretense that Jews are white. And what you point out to them is that Jews control the banks, Jews control the media, Jews control the politics, and Jews rule. Mm-hmm. When it comes down to it. And if you don't like what's going on in this country, as most white people don't, you don't like the Jews. You just don't realize it yet that it is the Jews. And maybe at some point in their brain, and I think, again, looking back in my own travels, that it wasn't that I didn't see the evidence of it. It is that I refused to confront it for my whole life. It was... not that I was totally ignorant of it. And that's the first thing to do, is to get them to acknowledge that all of this stuff is going on, right? So then you come to the Jewish problem. And the Jewish problem is really just the flip side of anti-Semitism, right? It's what the conflict of interest is called from a white point of view. It's called the Jewish problem. The Jews call it anti-Semitism. You could say it's from a Jew point of view, it's the non-Jew problem. We non-Jews call it the Jewish problem. And historically, it's the problem that Jews create for us. The fact is that Jews aren't white. They're genetically distinct, so their DNA is different. They're ideologically hostile. This is probably even more important, that even if you could get over the fact that they are genetically similar, they're ideologically 180 degrees different from whites. They see themselves, the core of their identity, if you pay attention to their blood libel narrative and their Holocaust narrative, is that whites are the enemy. And especially when they get on their soapbox and lecture everyone about what the blood libel means to them and what the Holocaust means to them, you can see it. They lay it out for you, that their time amongst Europeans for two millennia has been nothing but them being victimized by Europeans. It's an inversion of reality. It's, you know, they've lived amongst Europeans by their own choice. They came up from the Middle East and to live amongst Europeans, and they continue to come to live amongst Europeans and insist upon living upon us, amongst us, because they benefit from it, and they know they benefit from it, but they flip it around. That's one of the most basic psychological tricks that they use, is they flip it around and blame whites for the conflict of interest between the two groups.
Yeah, it's interesting. The topic of anti-Semitism, it's something that I've written quite a bit about on my website, and it's fascinating. I mean, literally, if you look at, you know, I mean, I follow the Jewish press and organizations like the Anti-Defamation League, and when they talk about anti-Semitism, they are basically talking about people who criticize Jews and who make basic observations about Jews, and people who literally quote Jews themselves, you know, to demonstrate what sort of agenda they're promoting and you know, what these Jews are up to. That is what anti-Semitism is. It is telling the truth about the Jews. I mean, it's really incredible that they continue to really, you know, use this word as a weapon against us. And I mean, there's other words, racist and, you know, white supremacist, and there's many others. But I think the Jews have been very effective in weaponizing our political discourse and using it against whites.
Yes. Yeah. And the key is that it has to do with point of view. And it's the relationship between whites and Jews specifically is like one of those drawings that you can see from one of two ways. It's actually called a Reuben vase, is the most classic example of that. It's you could go and look it up. I just looked it up today to find out if there was a name for it. And it's based on this, according to Wikipedia, a Danish psychologist who turns out, of course, to be a Jew. But it's, from the Jewish point of view, it's just mindless, senseless hate of Jews for no reason whatsoever. And whites, in typical fashion, we step outside of ourselves. We don't even take our own side in this. We step outside of ourselves, see it objectively as a conflict of interests, and see it as a struggle between equals. And what I've come to realize over time, you know, initially that's how I saw it, as when I first woke up to it. It's like, oh, well, there's a conflict here between two groups. The Jews have their own identity and whites should have their own identity, and we're at odds with each other, at least some of the time. And what I've come to realize is that it's actually far worse than that. It's whites have no identity in large part because Jews attack whatever sign we show of any sort of consciousness of our racial common interests. Mm-hmm. And they attack brutally. I mean, it's you know, just about everything that they accuse the whites of doing to them, they are actually responsible for doing themselves. I mean, they're basically projecting their own malice mm-hmm. onto their enemies.
Right. Yeah. And we see how Jews frame anti-Semitism as always some irrational, you know, crazed expression of just anti-Jewish hatred for no reason. You know, there's no evidence or any points that these anti-Semites are making. They're just these crazy individuals. And they've also literally pathologized white identity to where if you actually recognize the fact that you are white and, you know, you care about the future of white people, you care about our history and our traditions, you are again, crazy and irrational. I mean, it's just incredible what they've been able to do. And I think, for example, Dr. Kevin MacDonald in Culture Critique really explains this all very, very well. And that kind of gets into my next question. What are some of the most important books you would recommend or that, you know, you've read dealing with these topics?
Yeah, definitely Kevin MacDonald is the most important, I would have to mention first. And especially for someone who's first waking up to race and the Jews. It's a very detailed explanation of what's been happening historically, and it largely cites Jews themselves as the source of lots of quotes and facts about the case. And The Culture Critique, of course, is 3-volume set. I've never read that cover to cover myself. I've actually, you know, gone beyond it. I mean, it's definitely worth it if somebody wants to read it from cover to cover. And I've read large sections of it as certain topics became of interest to me. And there's one particular subset that he wrote about the Jewish involvement in immigration into the United States that I forward probably once a month to somebody or another whenever immigration comes up and people act like it just happened out of the blue, you know, what's going on with our open borders. And I thought McDonald made a great case there in that chapter that he wrote about that. And he made it available as a separate PDF, which is relatively short and easy to read. He also wrote quite a lot of effective stuff about cultural Marxism, the Frankfurt School, Franz Boas. And so if you're trying to figure out, you know, how did we get to this state of race and what happened to race science, then McDonald is a great source for that. He was inspired. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say really quick. I have read Culture of Critique, but I haven't read, I think there's 2 books that precede Culture of Critique in this series, and I haven't read those. But, I mean, that book is absolutely essential reading because it brilliantly and very scholarly explains and analyzes the systematic Jewish assault on Western civilization from a cultural perspective, from an intellectual perspective, from a scientific perspective. I mean, these Jews literally took over the West, you know, academically and even politically now. Obviously, that's very obvious now. But back in the 40s and 50s, you know, as you mentioned, cultural Marxism in the Frankfurt School, topics that McDonald expertly addresses and gives a history of, you know, these radical Jewish intellectuals literally took over Western civilization and have been undermining and destroying it ever since. And, you know, we can demonstrate this with ease. I mean, this is no secret. These Jews openly admit it. It's just, how do we get people to actually understand all this? Because there is a lot to it. And I mean, I think you can summarize it and break it down pretty, you know, simply. But I mean, if you want all the details, you have to read Culture Critique.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at when I said it depends on your point of view, whether something is anti-Semitism or not. And what McDonald does is he quotes Jews saying these things, and they say it as if it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, McDonald is presenting it in a way that puts it in a bad light, in a negative light, bad for Europeans, that it's been destructive to European society, European civilization. And that's what makes it anti-Semitism. If you're seeing it from a Jewish point of view, yeah, now somebody quoting all these Jews saying all these poisonous things about whites and white civilization, yeah, that's anti-Semitism. Right. From our point of view, it's a documenting of the Jewish problem.
Right.
So
of the Jewish, you know, genocidal agenda against the white race, and that absolutely is what they're up to.
Right, and it is an agenda, and it is organized. It's a conscious thing. Now you can see in the trilogy, McDonald himself has talked about how he himself became more and more aware of just how deep this problem was, and how I don't want to put words in his mouth, but you know how negative it was. He started off basically just studying the Jews abstractly, objectively. And by the Culture of Critique, he was really making an argument in favor of whites, you know, basically pointing the finger of blame at Jews.
Right.
For what has happened, and certainly in the last 200 years or so, I think, is what he covers. Now, he was inspired by a book, in part he was inspired by a book he came across that I have read cover to cover. It was John Murray Cudahy, The Ordeal of Civility. And the subtitle is Marx, Freud, and Levi-Strauss. So focusing on 3 particular Jews that are iconic of this, what McDonald calls Jewish intellectual movements. These gurus that lead whole troops of Jews, or mostly Jews anyway. You know, part of what McDonald documents is how Jews put Goy out front, or several Goy out front to, you know, basically be the face of a movement. But Cudahy, and Cudahy's actually far more objective, or at least comes across that way. As an Irishman, he's even comes across as sort of sympathetic to the Jews, to their outsider adversarial point of view towards the West and towards Anglo-Saxons in particular. And although the thing is, it's not just the Anglo-Saxons that Jews don't like. It's the Germans they don't like. It's the Swedes they don't like. It's Americans they don't like. It's really any host that basically they have to subdue in order to benefit from, in order to exploit. So, mm-hmm. And that's, you know, the MacDonald and Cudahy are both kind of hesitant to identify Jews as an enemy or use any terms that go beyond an objective evaluation of the situation. I mean, MacDonald goes farther than Cudahy does in laying out the hostility, and it speaks for itself, really, when you lay it out that way, that they're the enemy, that they think of us as the enemy. I do it myself when I describe how, you know, the Jewish identity is centered on the core of it is identifying whites or any host that they live amongst, really, but whites are our concern and the most recent host for them as the enemy. And mm-hmm. That whites, if we have a failing at all, it's in not recognizing that. You know, we're part of the psychological trick that they play is that they constantly accuse us of being of stupidly, crazily blaming Jews for everything. When the real problem is that whites, if you want to generalize about the problem, is whites don't blame Jews for enough. Whites underestimate Jews. They misunderstand Jews. Mm-hmm. So it's really a problem of underestimating them.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I think that goes to the heart of our problems here in America and really the wider Western world, is that we have never really, well, at least in America, we have never really dealt seriously with the Jewish problem, and it absolutely is a huge problem. And guys, if you don't believe me, I'm going to have a link over here to the Renegade Tribune, and it's an article called Quotes in Support of White Genocide, and it's just a list of Jews making just some of the most outrageous, truly genocidal comments about white people. And I mean, this is something that's been going on for a very, very long time. Certainly during World War II, that's what World War II was all about. It was all about destroying the one man who actually did stand up to the Jews and actually did expose and explain, and even in simple terms, the Jewish problem to, you know, his nation, and that was Adolf Hitler's Germany. But yeah, I mean, that is really what all this boils down to, is we are not real about race, and even more importantly, we're not real about the Jewish question, or the Jewish problem, I should say.
Yeah, Hitler is another one to mention. Mein Kampf. I haven't read Mein Kampf cover to cover either. I've read large sections of it, and there's nothing that Hitler has ever, in any translated speech I've ever seen, or any tract of text that he's written, nothing that I can find that he's wrong about. As far as I can tell, he was
Amen.
Telling the truth, and
yeah,
and
absolutely.
He told it very well. He was very articulate in expressing himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was by far the most powerful and, you know, impactful book that I read, especially waking up to racial realism and the Jewish problem. You know, I was really into, I originally got started in all this and sort of woke up to the Jewish problem by researching 9/11 and coming to the obvious conclusion that 9/11 was actually done by Israel and an international network of Jewish criminals, and most certainly not Osama bin Laden and 19 Arab, you know, terrorist hijackers. What an absurd, ridiculous story that is. But that was my awakening to the Jewish problem. But I didn't really get, you know, into the racial issues until I read Mein Kampf, and it, I mean, everything really clicked once I read that book. And it's interesting, you know, I remember reading, I think it's like chapter 11 maybe, or chapter 12, and I think it's called Nation and State, or Nation and Race maybe. I can't remember the exact name of the chapter, but it's a really, I mean, it's, in my opinion, probably the best chapter in the whole book. And he deals with race, and he talks about how the white race, the Aryan man, I think he exactly says, is the founder of civilization, and the Jews have always been parasites and the corruptors and subverters of civilization. And, you know, I really just read that and was so blown away. I'd never really heard it, history articulated like that. You know, wow, did white people really invent, like, civilization and all the technology we use today? And the more I thought about it, the more obvious it became that absolutely we did. We are the founders of civilization. No other races have accomplished anything even close to what we've accomplished. And I don't think that that's wrong or supremacist for making that basic factual observation.
Yeah. About 9/11, let's talk about that in a little while. I have a difference of opinion with you on 9/11, but it's let's talk about that in a bit.
Yeah, sure.
Just to continue, the influential books that are worth reading, the influential people who have said things about Jews, Revelo Oliver is definitely one of the more recent and important. William Pierce, you could add to that. But Oliver's Jewish strategy is very good and highlighted just for me just how far back in time this goes, that it's an ancient – the Jewish problem is an ancient problem. It's not something that started when Europeans first started to wake up to the biological reality of race in the 17th, 18th centuries.
Right.
Arthur Gobineau is another one, who predated Hitler. And by the way, that chapter you mentioned, chapter 12, I'm not sure if that's it either, but Race and Nation, where he talks about that. I got into that in some detail when I was discussing Francis Parker Yockey's book, which is not worth reading, I don't think. Mm. I mean, I think he's
Imperium,
and he's a great writer, and he got lots of things right, but I think on race he was wrong. And he dedicated his book to the hero of World War II, and he did it just shortly after World War II. He was writing when everybody else was, or most other people were, putting distance between themselves and the National Socialists and Hitler. He wrote a book about it and dedicated the book to Hitler. But what I pointed out, that his views on race, Yockey's views on race, were kind of wishy-washy and spiritual. He was against rationalism and Darwinism because he saw those as some outgrowth of Jewishness rather than as an outgrowth of Aryan objectivity. And I contrasted Yockey's opinion on race and nation and the malleability, the plasticity of race, of biological attributes like skull shape. Yockey went into or bought the Boas fraud, which was this idea that if you move a person from one place to another, the ground shapes them. Now, this is funny because Darwinism is basically that theory, but Darwinism explains it as taking generations. Generation after generation has to is shaped by its environment. That's the basic idea behind natural selection. But it was even more instructive to just contrast what Yockey was saying about race with what Hitler had to say. You know, his hero, he apparently did, he missed that chapter, I guess,
right?
When trying to understand Hitler's views about race. And Hitler's views about race, I believe, come down from Arthur Gobineau. I don't know if he read the book himself directly, but Gobineau's Inequality of Human Races describes a very popular view of the importance of race and the differences not just between whites and blacks and yellows, whatever, the continental races, but the differences amongst whites themselves. Gobineau used the term race in a very fine-grained sense that used to be used for nation. What nation used to mean was a sort of sub-race, a more, a narrower group of people related natally. And Gobineau was talking really about the distinctions amongst Europeans. And he saw at that time, he was writing in the 1850s or so, whites were just stomping all over the world, conquering and colonizing everywhere. And it seemed like everywhere the whites went, the non-white races were sort of withering and dying away. And he, from his vantage point, it was like whites were going to dominate the planet. I think the criticism of Gobineau is that, in retrospect, is he didn't appreciate the Jews like other Europeans in his time, and even up until today, you have many Europeans that just either are blind to the Jews or consider them some sort of fossil people. I think Gobineau actually used that term, and later it was used by people like Toynbee and Spengler also. And that attitude is just wrong. The Jews are not a fossil people, that they're implying that they're just inert and ancient and unchanging. It's they are a very dynamic and deadly force, very much alive, very much active in what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And then the last influential source I would urge is something I just became aware of myself recently, is a book called The Great Jewish Mask, which is, the author is unknown. People have speculated about it. It was published, I think, by Arnold Leese's, he had something to do with the publishing of it. From the way the text is phrased itself, came out in 1920, I think, or thereabouts. It seemed to me like it was Leese's voice from other things I had heard from or read of Arnold Leese. Basically an exposure of the Jews as historic fraudsters, that the Jewish narrative throughout history, the telling of history from the Jewish point of view, is a giant lie. It's a series of lies, things, elements of who they are that are just made up. I think the subtitle is something like the donkey in the lion's skin, or something, the ass in the lion's skin, mm-hmm. Which is some ancient European fable that it describes the Jews as basically making themselves out to be heroic and brave and great, when the reality is quite the opposite, that they're very secretive. And this idea of Jews using masks and disguising themselves is something that you find basically every insightful critic of Jews has noticed, including MacDonald, including Revelo Oliver, Hitler, that they use disguises. MacDonald calls it crypsis. And this is, MacDonald comes closest, I think, to putting a biological interpretation on what they're doing, closest to calling it out as parasitism, without calling it parasitism, or at least until recently. Mm-hmm. He's kind of shied away from that. But when you look up what crypsis is, and Jewish crypsis is basically just this use of camouflage, disguising who they are. It's a good word. It's a sort of technical sounding term to describe what they do. One aspect of their fraud, which is the fraud about who they are.
Right.
That's what this Jewish Mask book is about. It's about the fraud of their history. Of course, you know, fraud and Jew go together in many more ways, financial fraud and scientific fraud and so on.
Right. Now, in Mein Kampf, Hitler actually talks about, the greatest Jewish deception is that they are this religious minority rather than a hostile foreign racial element undermining society. And
right.
I think that really is what it boils down to. We have to understand that the Jews are a foreign racial entity, not merely a religious community. You know, a lot of people get confused and say, oh, well, Jews are white, they just have a different religion. And that's just not the case at all. I mean, Jews themselves denounce their whiteness and you know, boldly proclaim their Jewishness. You know what I mean? So,
right. And that they're Jews even when they're atheist and so forth. But, and you're right. That's, I skipped over that. When you're having that conversation with people who, they maybe are awake to race, but they insist that Jews are white. That's the kind of people that you have to have this heart-to-heart, lay it on the table that, no, Judaism is not what Jews are about. It's their peoplehood, really. That's the term that they use for it, the euphemism for race that they use. They talk about the continuity of their peoplehood and how important that is to them. And they talk about the evil of assimilation and intermarriage, two more kind of code words that they use, which is, you know, if whites were talking in the kind of way that Jews talk about it, whites would be accused of being horrible hater racists, you know, for thinking of things in such terms. But the Jews do it more or less openly. They, you know, using this coded speech for it, but they all know what they're talking about, and they all know that it's their strength. And they know it's their undoing if they were to, say, open the borders of Israel to aliens. Even the Syrians, who are their next door neighbors and genetically close to them, they don't want to open their borders to, and it's not because of religion.
Right. Yeah.
Religion is just an organizing principle for them. It helps them to maintain their racial integrity, their racial purity.
Yes, I completely agree. And that's the most outrageous aspect of the Jewish problem, is just their blatant, in your face, truly insulting hypocrisy, where, for example, we have wall-to-wall Jewish support. I mean, every single Jewish organization in America, in Europe, they're all demanding that the West accept unlimited and totally unrestricted, you know, refugees from the Middle East, quote-unquote refugees. I mean, yeah. These people are invaders. And yet, as you mentioned, in Israel, they're not taking in any refugees.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's other examples of Jewish hypocrisy, but this one is just so blatant and in your face, and it's so relevant today, obviously, with what's going on in Europe.
Hypocrisy is mainly a point of view that appeals to whites. It's how we see the world, as, you know, the world should be fair and equal and whatever, you know, we view it objectively, right? Objective groups in competition, but we duke it out man to man at sunrise, with pistols or with swords or whatever. That sort of tradition, that mindset. Whereas the Jews, what's behind this supposed hypocrisy or this double standard is really just a single standard. It's what's best for the Jews. And what's best for the Jews in Israel is different than what's best for the Jews outside of Israel. Outside of Israel, they want to be treated as just one of many different types of people, where they can be free to foment division and exploit those divisions amongst other people. And so having open borders everywhere so they can move freely about, and so that they can move other peoples freely about, is what's in their best interest. Whereas in Israel, that's their home. That's their nest. They don't want to screw that up. So
yep,
that's
exactly
the explanation.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. Now, I'm curious, are you familiar with The Dispossessed Majority by Wilmot Robertson?
Wilmot Robertson, another book that I have not read cover to cover, but I've read large sections of, and I'm kind of critical of Wilmot
Robertson. That's
just a
phenomenal book, actually, I think.
I like the book overall, but I think he minimizes the Jewish problem. I think, for instance, he doesn't state it as the Jewish problem. He just lists Jews as one of the unassimilable minorities alongside Greeks and Southern Italians and a few other groups that, you know, he basically, his language to me is where the weakness begins, that this thinking of things in terms of majority and minority, instead of saying white. And he, another thing that I remember about his point of view is he really disliked the term white, and for good reason, I think, because white had been used by the Jews. They had basically shoehorned their way into America by making the argument that they were white, and being mistaken as white by the Americans who had control to exclude them at that point, on the basis that they weren't white. And you brought it up earlier that America, when it was founded, I think they thought that they were leaving the Jewish problem behind in Europe, and there weren't that many Jews in America, and there wasn't going to be a problem with Jews in America anyway, because the Jews were started off emancipated in the U.S., whereas they still weren't fully emancipated in Europe at the time. They just started off as equal and white in America, at least the Germanized Western Jews that were in America at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 1880s, when Eastern European Jews started flooding into America, it was obvious that these were alien people with alien patterns of thinking and hostile to Americans. And many Americans pointed this out, but Wilmot Robertson was long past, you know, he should have had the benefit of hindsight, writing in the 70s as he was, that, you know, to just sort of, I don't want to accuse him of pussyfooting, like he'd use that term about, or truckling, that there were certain whites in power at the time that obviously had some sort of racial consciousness, like Richard Nixon. And he was, in fact, the title of his book, Dispossessed Majority, was a play on some term that Nixon used at the time. The I forget what it was now, but back to the language of majority versus minority. Majority is not what makes us us. We could be in the minority, and white is still important. And even white, if you don't like the term white because it lets Jews in, well, then that means you should be more explicit about saying, no, Jews aren't white. They're the enemy of whites. Mm-hmm. And I understand also that some people are very Northwestern European, entirely in their heritage. They like that, and they want to preserve that, and so they're very standoffish toward whites that are further out on the fringes of Europe. Perfectly understandable and perfectly defensible. They should just be able to say, this is our country, we created this country, we're Northwestern Europeans, and we're not going to let you in. Not because we're the majority, but because we're Northwestern Europeans. We're related to each other. We're more closely related to each other than we are to you. Yep. And so there's no, I see no problem in the, you know, having different gradations of and different levels of clustering of race. You know, race is not a black and white thing necessarily. For a particular group to exist as it is, it has to make a distinction between us and them. That's a very basic biological distinction. And over time, it's what produces speciation. This, you know, populations, even if they start out being totally related to each other, they cleave for some reason. Geography is often what's to do with it. And amongst amongst humans, it's, or hominids, it's, it has to do with language and cultural differences. But then, it's like the law of entropy in physics. It in species, speciation is the natural way of things. This dividing, this constant dividing of different species into other species, into other separate groups that breed amongst each other and exclusively. And if they do that long enough, then they actually become incapable of breeding with each other over time.
Interesting. Okay, I wanted to move on here and talk about this. It's sort of a, well, I guess in the past couple years, I hear people talking and writing more and more about it, and that's this idea of pathological altruism, which is put forth. I mean, I've heard Dr. Kevin MacDonald write about it and talk about it. You know, all sorts of pro-white intellectuals and activists and whatnot. Jared Taylor comes to mind as well. And, I mean, I think that there maybe is something to this idea of pathological altruism, but from the way that I understand a lot of their arguments, they seem to be basically saying that this is something that is innate, like an innate weakness in white people. And I don't really agree with that. And after hearing some of your critiques of this idea of pathological altruism, I think that there is a root cause of pathological altruism. There is something that is making us this way. It's not something that's necessarily innate within us. And I think that's more of the argument someone like Dr. Kevin MacDonald or Jared Taylor would be making. What are your thoughts on this? And maybe if I got anything wrong there, please go ahead and clarify.
Well, I think I'm the main critic. I'm the one who basically started this, because what I saw from my point of view, it started about 2 years ago, this talk about white pathology. And it solidified ultimately into pathological altruism as the specific pathology that people were talking about. And it definitely has broad appeal. I saw it, you know, being echoed in many different places. But I didn't like it from the beginning, because I thought white pathology, that's, you know, describing the symptoms. It's not describing the cause. What is the cause? And that's my main critique of it, is if you've got a pathology, well, what's the pathogen?
Right.
Where's the germ that's creating this problem, as you said?
I'm sorry, Tan, really quick, how would you describe pathological altruism? Like, what are the main points of this argument? Just so people sort of have an understanding of what we mean by pathological altruism.
Right. It's a technical term. Altruism is that from biology and the study of all species, not just how humans behave, but in this case, it's specifically about white people. Altruism is when a person or an organism makes a personal sacrifice that benefits someone else, right? And it becomes pathological altruism when it's benefiting your enemy or somebody who's totally alien from you. It's one thing to be altruistic toward your kids, or toward your siblings' offspring, you know, toward your nieces and nephews. They're not directly your offspring, but you still share some genes with them, and so you still share some interests with them biologically, culturally. So it makes sense. And likewise to the people around you in your race, they are all within the same gene pool with you. They are much more likely to share cultural and political interests with you than complete strangers, complete genetic biological aliens. So pathological altruism is this idea, as you said, you put it very well. What I sensed in it too, and my critique of it, is that it's basically the accusation that whites are born losers, that we're born to just give away and born to just be suicidal. Mm-hmm. And that's what I immediately connected it to, was my previous critique of people who looked at what's going wrong. They sense that something's wrong, and they look around, and then they've got these people who tell them it's suicide. You know, Europeans are just killing themselves. Mm-hmm. And I hated that before white pathology came along. As far as I'm concerned, white pathology is basically the suicide meme 2.0. It's a refinement.
It's a more intellectual variation of it. Yeah.
But like I say, it's an explanation, supposedly, for people who are deciding that something's wrong, but they want to know what's wrong. It's an answer to their question. And it's more, white pathology is more specific than suicide. Pathological altruism is more specific than white pathology. Mm-hmm. So the thing to remember is this idea comes from Jared Taylor. He's the main proponent of this white pathology, pathological altruism idea. The thing about Jared Taylor is he presents himself as pro-white, but he also at the same time says Jews are white, that they look white to him. And that he talks about race very explicitly, but for him, race means black and white, or black and white and brown and yellow. But Jews are a totally separate problem in his opinion, that it's unrelated. He mentioned in one time when he was put on the spot about this, that he doesn't want to be considered a crank on two issues at one time. And I thought that's really curious, because race and the Jews are intimately related to each other. They're basically the same problem. The reason why anti-racism exists is because the Jews drive it. The Jews are the ones attacking whites, calling us racist, psychopathologizing us for even thinking in terms of race. It's the Jews doing that. Now, I don't know how Jared Taylor could think about race day in and day out and not realize that the Jews are genetically distinct, that they have this hostility ideologically and politically to whites, and that it's a historic problem. It's been going on for millennia. At first I was very charitable toward Jared Taylor because I saw him as a pro-white voice. He's out in the open under his own name, organizing activity, writing very eloquently and speaking very eloquently. But on this issue of the Jews, he is dishonest at the very least. I don't think he's self-deceiving himself. I don't think he really thinks that this is some sort of clever strategy that he's going to sneak up on the Jews, because if he does, he's a fool. You can't sneak up on the Jews. The Jews are far more racially conscious than any white person I've ever read. Even Hitler talks about how he was naive about the Jews and learned about the Jews only later in life. And that's the general trend with whites, that we only wake up to this late in life, if we wake up to it at all, whereas Jews are teaching their young that the Amalekites need to be genocided, that the anti-Semites need to be hunted down, that the Nazis need to be not tolerated, killed. Mm-hmm. It's
the Klan,
are trained as soldiers from the get-go, from the time that they can first speak. They go to special Jewish schools for that purpose, whereas whites go to schools where Jews are the teachers, teaching them that whiteness is bad, racism. It's giving us the complete opposite story.
Exactly. Yeah, and of course they're forcing our kids to go to school with Negroes and all sorts of other non-whites, and we're taught that whites are the most evil people on the face of the planet, and we're responsible for slavery and the Holocaust and genocide and you name it. It goes on and on and on. But getting back to
pathological
altruism. I was going to say real quick, I think I agree with most of what you just said about it. This idea that white people, collectively you know, as societies, our governments, for example, and other, you know, white institutions and organizations, the Catholic Church and some of these other, you know, mainstream Christian organizations, the idea that they are literally putting the interests of other racial groups, of hostile alien racial groups, ahead of the of their own. I mean, that is obviously what's going on. You know, that's public policy in the United States. That's how many organizations operate in the United States. But I don't think that it's really something that's innate within us. I think it's a result of propaganda. I think it's a result of the white race being entirely deracinated, you know, at least collectively. And fundamentally, I think it is a result of the Jews, of the parasitic, subversive nature of the Jews and what they do to us when we don't recognize them as the, you know, alien, hostile race of people that they really are.
Right. They have agency. They are very, very active. They are very, very conscious. They're more conscious than whites are as to their interests as a group, their existence as a group, and what they need to do to not only survive but thrive. And whites are not. And part of the reason whites are not, the largest part, the proximate cause, as a lawyer would say, is Jews. Okay, that's
right.
So the first approximation. That's the number one cause of this. Now, my critique of pathological altruism, what really set me off was when I noticed that every time that it came up, the specific examples that I saw being offered, what is pathological altruism exactly? Can you, you know, point to something concrete? It was always things like cat ladies or these people who adopt alien babies from Africa or Asia. And, you know, or basically what they would previously have just said, white liberalism. You know, what is liberalism? It's a vague term, but these are specific examples, this cat lady and alien adoption thing. And what I noticed about this is not a cause. This is a symptom of the poisonous media that what's presented by this Jewish media as good and right is this kind of stuff. And it's no wonder that people go and do it. They, you know, I think people naturally do what they look around and they see everybody else clucking about and either in favor of or against. And so, you know, we've stopped being a racially conscious group where we talked about miscegenation as if it was a bad thing. And now we talking about miscegenation as a bad thing is a bad thing.
Yeah.
Because of the Jews. That's, you know,
that's a
direct
not white
result. People who decided to do that on our own.
Right. It's a direct,
result
of Jewish propaganda and
Jewish
influence. Of
enemy activity.
Yep.
Yeah. If the enemy drops bombs on your city, do you blame yourself for letting your city burn?
Right.
You know, the enemy dropped bombs on you. You fight the fires, but you don't lie to yourself that you caused the fires.
Right.
So
yeah. So, I mean, really, I think what it boils down to is that the root cause of pathological altruism, you know, among white people is really two interrelated factors. Number one, the denial of race, you know, the denial that white people have interests and we need to be concerned about them and to think racially. But also sort of, you know, obviously very much related to this is the Jewish problem.
Yes.
And what the Jews are up to and what their agenda is. So, I mean, if we continue to deny these realities that we need to deal with, you know, we're going to continue to suffer this pathological altruism, and we're going to continue to watch our countries and our nations crumble.
Yeah. So as far as McDonald goes, he has taken up this white pathology and pathological altruism argument. He got it from Jared Taylor. I think he parrots it because he respects Jared Taylor as a colleague, you know, another academic intellectual type who has pro-white intentions. I think he's mistaken there, but McDonald is responsible for taking it a step farther. McDonald has actually tried to come up with a thesis that literally roots it in our genes. He's argued that this pathological altruism is inborn and it comes from our Ice Age hunter-gatherer ancestors, that because of the climate in which white people evolved for 15,000 years during the Ice Ages, that sort of laid the pattern in our genes that we are genetically programmed to be egalitarian and tolerant, and that we form moral groups rather than ethnic groups, and groups based on ideas rather than groups based on tribal family relations, like the Middle Easterners do, like the Jews do. And I think, you know, that all could be very true. But I think
there is something to a lot of his arguments, but maybe we would just interpret them differently.
Well, one problem is this, that, you know, he points to Sweden as the epitome of the problem of white pathological altruism, white pathology. And the problem with that is, you know, he says it's because Northern Europeans are the most hunter or gatherer of all the different Europeans. They have the most hunter gatherer. They also have the most Aryan in them genetically. Mm-hmm. And the Aryan mindset is like completely at odds with this squishy, wishy-washy, liberal type of attitude. There are some similarities. I haven't really written about this before, but I have thought about it, how, you know, egalitarianism is not purely a hunter-gatherer thing. You can see elements of it in this band of brothers, peer type attitude that even the Aryans had, that that they were amongst equals, even the nobility at least. You know, they saw an aristocracy, they saw differences and the need for hierarchy. But amongst the people at the top, the Aryans at the top who were running whatever society they conquered, they saw themselves as a band of brothers, as equals in a way, within that group.
Yeah, and I think some of these qualities and characteristics that MacDonald talks about and you know, sort of ties it to evolution and you know, how whites evolved and throughout the Ice Age and whatnot, and the geography that, you know, we were living in and whatnot. I think there is something to these arguments, but I think what's even more important is that the Jews, you know, sort of recognize these traits and exploit them. Yes. to the hilt. I mean, really, like, well, they understand our psychology. They have, you know, really studied these things. I mean, look at Bernays and all these other Jewish propagandists. They know how to do this stuff scientifically.
Yes, manipulative. They're manipulative, and they're ruthless in the manipulation. They're hyper aware, hypersensitive, and willing to do whatever they have to do to manipulate their host to behave however they need it to behave, and or to, you know. And that's the thing about MacDonald, is you can use his own arguments that he makes in Cultural Critique, and he's made sense. He went on, he had two recent interviews with Nordfront that were very, very good. I recommend to anyone who likes MacDonald. And he himself lays out that, you know, he thinks culture is very important and that it's critical. That's why he wrote a book about the Culture of Critique. And yet, and as I say, that the Jewish influence in recent history is the proximate cause for the degeneracy that we see around us. All the stuff that people point at and say, that's pathological altruism. Well, the Jewish fingerprints are all over it. The Jewish control and dominance of the media and the sick messages that they send out, that, you know, portraying this degeneracy as normal, as heroic, as something to celebrate. Mm-hmm. That's the number one cause of the degeneracy that you see, is people ingesting that poison. And it's no wonder that people get sick and die from that kind of stuff.
Yes, very well said. Yeah, and I want to talk more about the Jewish media here in a few minutes. Really quickly, you mentioned this idea of white suicide, and this is something that I actually do hear. Well, I have heard Jared Taylor talk about this idea of white suicide, how whites are literally committing suicide and implementing policies that are suicidal in nature. And again, I mean, I think that is a very flawed argument, because I think they're not suicidal. I think they're genocidal. And they're coming from the organized Jewish community, and they're puppets. You know, they're goyim puppets that are, you know, right, and in key positions of power and influence in America, certainly. And, you know, what's incredible is really most important positions in the federal government, in Congress, in the Obama administration, are actually controlled by Jews themselves. So it's certainly not suicidal if the Jews are a racial foreign, you know, element, are implementing policies that are destructive to us. That's not suicide. That's right. Genocide.
That's right. That's right. They don't identify positively with whites. In fact, they identify negatively. They see whites as the enemy. So yeah, it's not suicide. It's you know, the number one tip off is that suicide is a very personal decision. You consciously decide, I'm going to end my life for whatever reason, and you do it. That's suicide.
Yep.
What's happening is people the people who actually control the levers of power, or at least have some sort of influence over it, they are the figureheads. For instance, the president of the United States, president of various other countries in Europe, they are not suicidal. They are almost the polar opposite. They are so concerned about themselves and their own personal interest. And that's really what the problem is an over-concern for personal interests and a complete lack of consideration for their race, for the larger right. group. They think that they can live without their larger group.
And that, to me, that is the epitome of this idea of whites being deracinated. There's mm-hmm. a disconnect between, you know, whites as individuals and whites as a wider community, a wider racial community.
Right.
And I mean, we have to understand that, you know, we have to understand that we are part of a wider community, and, you know, we have to start thinking in these terms. I mean, if we want to compete and eventually, you know, retake our countries. Right. And I think that is happening. You know, I think there are more people sort of realizing these things. Go ahead.
Beyond merely competing, it's we have to go beyond just seeing the Jews as yet another group that wants to exploit us. And that's where we come to, I think, what is a better thesis for understanding the relationship between whites and Jews is parasitism. That if you look at it in biological terms, and the Jews are constantly dropping hints that you should look at it in biological terms. When they talk about anti-Semitism, they talk about it as a disease. They talk about it as an infection, as a virulent thing. And the reality is that they're the, you know, if you look up virulence, you find out, what does virulence mean? Virulence is the technical term for the damage that a parasite causes its host. That's what virulence is. The more virulent a parasite is, the more damaging it is, the more deadly it is to its host. And actually, the Nordfront guys brought up a point that a true parasite basically can coexist with its host for an extended period of time, whereas a parasite-like entity that kills its hosts is called a parasitoid. So I thought that was interesting. A fine distinction. They're parasitic, basically. And that's the best way, I think, to make sense of all of it. That it mm-hmm. all of the pieces fall into place when you understand it that way. Many, many people, even people who aren't racialists, have written about the financial parasitism of the banker class or the donor class or, you know, whatever, that they are behaving in a parasitic way financially. Well, financial is just one aspect of the whole thing. The Israel lobby and Zionism is another, more, you know, it's related to money, but it's also about sovereignty. It's about redirecting the resources of many other nations to the benefit of Israel, shipping them money, shipping them arms, making promises to protect them. The leaders of the United States and European countries say things about in defense of Jews in Israel that they would never say about even defending their own countries that they run. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Trump is a good example of that.
So that was actually the next topic. I mean, this idea of the really the most accurate way of viewing the Jew is as a parasite, right? I mean, that's really, in my opinion, and I think you've, you know, sort of elaborated on this in great detail on some of your radio shows about this reality. I mean, that is the way, you know, we have to understand these people. And again, this is something that the Germans talked about. You know, the National Socialists clearly understood this and wrote mm-hmm. about it, you know, sort of made it a central aspect of what they're trying to communicate to the German people. And as you mentioned, there's many forms of this parasitism, financial, obviously political. Look with the Holocaust industry. Mm-hmm. This is probably, in my view, I mean, the most outrageous and just truly infuriating, blood boiling. I mean, I cannot stand these Jews in this fake Holocaust story, in the way they just exploit us financially, emotionally, culturally. I mean, you can't avoid the Holocaust in the West today.
Yeah, that's right. The elements of the parasitism that came to me, it stood out to me, were the infiltration, the manipulation, the exploitation. This pretty much covers all of what the Jews do, how they do it, and that's all points to parasitism. They are exploiting secretively, furtively exploiting a host. They do whatever they can to subdue our defenses. In fact, what the Jews have done is hijacked our defenses. They've actually turned our defensive mechanisms, our defensive institutions, into institutions that benefit them, that protect them within our own countries. And yeah, the Holocaust is a big part of that.
Yeah, and that, yeah, exactly. And that kind of gets into the next topic, and that's this idea of, or this this cuckservative meme that sort of, you know, is a relatively recent phenomenon. I know, I'm pretty sure I've seen you write and talk about this subject, but I'm just curious, what are your general thoughts on it? And, well, and the idea that it expresses, because I think it is a very powerful, you know, devastating critique of
it is
American
devastating.
Politics.
I think most of the people who use the term are not even really fully conscious of just what it is that they're implying. I think many people are talking about it in terms of the interracial sex fetish, that cuckolding fetish. But it really traces back, the root of the whole concept is the exploitation of a parasite, of,
yes.
of its host.
Yes.
And the cuckoo bird. You know how the cuckoo bird is a giant bird, comes, lays a giant egg in some smaller bird's nest, and then that giant egg hatches into a giant, screeching, demanding chick, kicks the other birds out.
Disgusting bird, yeah. Just a disgusting
bird. It hatches early. You know, it's genetically different than the bird it's parasitizing, and it kicks out their eggs and then screeches at the top of its lungs to be serviced by the other bird. And you know, if you dig deeper into even that, and I haven't heard anybody but Jews really go into this. There's one Jewish biologist that wrote about this, how a cuckoo bird, actually there is a struggle between the cuckoo parasite and its host, that the host that tried to defend itself by, say, knocking the cuckoo bird egg out, the cuckoos will come and punish that bird by destroying its nest. And so this, you know, there's a give and take, there's a push back and forth. And I see that even, I haven't dug into the details of it yet, there's still lots to do with, you know, demonstrating the Jewish parasitism of Europeans over the course of millennia. But one of the elements is that you should see, if it is parasitism, is you should see some attempts by Europeans to sort of adapt and do something to defend themselves. In fact, you could see all of the expulsions that Europeans have done over the centuries as one bit of evidence in that that Europeans have tried to defend themselves. It's not suicide. They've repeatedly tried to defend themselves, but they're never able to achieve full consciousness, and they just end up kicking the problem next door. It's like if you've got roaches in a motel and you just gas one apartment, the roaches move next door to the other apartments, and then ultimately they filter right back into the apartment that was cleaned out. And that's what the Jews have actually adapted to, that kind of treatment of them over time too. They've counter-adapted to being expelled. It's part of their life cycle now, being expelled. They've made it into their narrative. The Holocaust narrative is really just the most recent example of the narrative that they've been telling for 2,000 years about how they've been horribly oppressed by every host that they've ever tried to exploit. Mm-hmm. And it's become the story that they tell. It's George Lincoln Rockwell wrote a great metaphor, a metaphorical story about it, the ducks and geese.
Right.
The parable of the ducks and geese.
Well, and we see how, you know, not only how important this fake Holocaust story and you know, just this narrative of Jewish persecution, we see how central this is to their overall agenda. But I mean, it's just something that defines them as Jews. It's a central aspect of their Jewish identity. I mean, yes. there's public polls. You know, the Pew Research Center does research on different ethnic groups in America, and the most important aspect of Jewish identity, when you ask Jews and when you poll Jews, whether it's in America or anywhere really in the whole world, is their identification with this fake Holocaust story, and that they're victims, and that their people have this history of oppression, and the whole world hates them.
Right. You
know,
that
it's
too.
A central aspect. Yeah.
That is the number one answer that they provided as to what it was that made them identify as Jews. And that is the number one thing that they cite themselves, Jews polling Jews, or Pew
exactly.
polling Jews about it.
You know, and another interesting aspect of Jewish parasitism and just how you know, effective it's been and how out of control it is in America is, again, going back to this idea of a cuckservative. We have these, you know, mostly white guys in the GOP and the Republican Party who portray themselves as these great American patriots, when in reality all they are doing is serving the interests of Jews on every single key aspect of public policy. Whether it's foreign policy, domestic policy, they always bow down to the Jews. And yet they're able to effectively present themselves as these American patriots and American heroes.
Right. Yeah, they're not cat ladies. They're selling out their own kind, either consciously or unconsciously, for their own personal benefit, for power, for fame, for fortune, whatever it is that drives them to do it. Or just there's also an angle to it of vicarious racial identity, that they know they can't identify as white. I think of this when I think of people like Limbaugh and Coulter and Hannity, although less, I think they're waking up to it a little bit themselves. But in the past, it seemed to me like people like that take a certain joy out of talking about Jews, you know, like they're this people to sympathize with and to defend, and to give your life in their defense just makes you the most wonderful person in the world. And the cuckservative thing cuts through all of that. And, you know, even more specifically, kikeservative emphasizes the fact that they are just – what they're doing is sick. If you want to talk about white pathology, that's the number one evidence of white pathology, is when people actively identify with their enemy and talk about their enemy in these glowing positive terms. That you've got to be they're mentally ill.
Yeah, I mean, they literally are servicing their own racial enemy, the racial element that wants to destroy everything that they stand for. It's amazing. It's
I don't mean
amazing.
To cop out and say, oh, they've got to be crazy, because I think that that's what it is. When people say, oh, my enemy is stupid or my enemy is crazy, what that really is they're copping out and saying, I can't explain it, or I don't want to explain it, so I'm just going to call it stupid or crazy. Mm-hmm. The reality is I think there is a way to make sense of what these people are doing, which is that they just don't care about their race. They in fact think their race is a liability, and they need to cut the cord with their race in order to progress, to make their career, or to at least maintain their career. That they have to act like they don't care. They have to show that they don't care. It's becoming more and more obvious, this Black Lives Matter thing and what happened at Mizzou, where you know, you're basically now being pressured, if you're in any form of position of power as a white man or white woman, to renounce your race and you know, accept guilt for your race. And that's part of what I didn't like about white pathology also, is it's basically related to that what white liberals do, denouncing their whiteness, is when white racialists talk about white pathology and pathological altruism, what are they doing? They're not saying they themselves are born pathological, they're behaving pathological. No, it's those other whites. It gives them a sort of boost in their brain to say, oh yeah, I'm not broken, but all those other whites are. It's taking responsibility in the most dishonest way, mm-hmm. of not really taking responsibility yourself personally, but saying somebody else is responsible for it. And the funny thing about that is when I've made this critique, the very first thing and the most, you know, the loudest criticism of me that comes at me is, oh, you just want to blame the Jews for everything. You want to, you know, shift all the blame to the Jews. And that's really, it's a stupid argument. It's simplistic. I mean, mm-hmm. it's easy to take it apart, that, you know, what I'm actually arguing is that there's two here. There's at least two parties involved, Jews and whites, and they're in conflict. And it's not that it's just the Jews or just whites. It's the people who say it's suicide that are really saying that it's that there's no Jews involved. Don't pay any attention to those Jews behind the curtain.
Exactly. It's all, you know, dumb whitey's fault. Yep.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to there's a couple other topics that I wanted to kind of wrap up with here. And one of them is two of the most important issues, in my opinion, two issues that are central to not only the white struggle, but just the struggle for truth and you know, honesty and decency and some sort of integrity in our society is, you know, being honest about the true history of World War II, so revisionism, and then 9/11 truth, you know, being honest about 9/11 and what really happened and who was really behind it. And it sounds like, based on your comment, you know, earlier in this interview, you might disagree with me on 9/11, but I'm just curious, what role do you see for revisionists, for, you know, people that are doing critical research into World War II, into World War I, into this alleged Jewish Holocaust story, which in my view has been thoroughly and conclusively debunked once and for all? I mean, we have the evidence and proof to explain everything that we're saying about this event, this alleged event. Yeah. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts on these two important topics?
I think different things, different issues appeal to different people because of where they're coming from, whatever their background is. I think in general, what you're getting at is there are these other sort of related movements that are on the periphery of the white struggle, what you call, you know, what is being pro-white, having a racial identity and fighting for your race. And it attracts, those other things attract truth seekers. That's the general description that you could to give to it. There are people that sense that there's a problem. They don't accept the mainstream narrative, the mainstream explanation for what the problems are. As I've pointed out many times, the mainstream explanation for what's wrong is racism, white supremacy. Those are the problems according to the Jewish mainstream narrative. And there are people who that doesn't compute with. I mean, they look at things like 9/11, or they look at things like the Holocaust, or other things that I can think of that are similar, men's rights, or even the counter-jihad people. They all are coming at it from different angles. It reminds me of that cartoon of the parable of the elephant, the wise men, the blind wise men, and the elephant. You know, they all feel a different part of the elephant. They all describe it in a different way, but it's all connected, and it's all, you know, the Jews are involved in behind all of it. The problem with these other things, whether it's 9/11 truth, and maybe to a less extent Holocaust revisionism, but certainly with men's rights and certainly with counter jihad, is that it's full of Jews. There are Jews trying to derail you. There are Jews trying to get you stuck just there. Don't go any further. Don't think about white racial consciousness. A lot of the people involved aren't white or are only half white, and there's a lot of half Jews or part Jews there too, or you know, pretending to be white, and there's a lot of gatekeeping going on. So it's a two-edged sword. Those other related areas, 9/11 included, are ways in which people see that there's something wrong with the system, and for them, different things are the straw that breaks the camel's back, and hopefully they then proceed through the gate to full racial consciousness, the full truth of it all.
Absolutely, yeah. And in my opinion, I mean, the racial issues are by far, you know, the most important issues that I'm dealing with. But I do think that, you know, revisionism and 9/11 truth and just being honest about the nature of the media, of the Jewish media, and how it's being used to deceive us and whatnot, just being, you know, honest about all of these subjects, I think is important and actually critical for our success. But I do agree with you. I mean, I think there are a lot of people in 9/11 truth that really kind of get bogged down, and, you know, they don't continue to progress to where we're at, you know, where we're talking about these racial issues.
Well, I've read people that have come through 9/11 truth. Mike Delaney is one that I think of,
right,
that have pointed out that there's lots and lots of Jews there creating disinformation. So they sense that there is something there that needs to be covered up. They sense that it's a weak point, and they flood in there as gatekeepers, as charlatans, to keep people busy just poking around all the different theories there. My own opinion about 9/11 is I don't know. I wasn't there. I'm not involved with it directly. I don't know anybody who – well, I knew a few people who were involved, were on at Ground Zero. I don't know anybody directly who was killed. They wouldn't be able to tell me anything anyway. But the thing is, it's some – whatever happened there is – the argument that I often hear is the argument you laid out pretty well. The Jews or Israel did 9/11, and we can be certain of that. And would only say to that is we can't be certain. I don't know that for certain that it was the president of Israel or a bunch of Israelis that planned the whole thing and did it. And you get into these gradations of argument where you can argue endlessly is just how much did Israel do? Did they, you know, at the very least, and what I'm comfortable with accepting is that they knew that there were Muslims that were doing it, and they didn't in any way communicate to United States security that this was going to happen. So they didn't prevent it. And you get finer, more and more gradations all the way to a surreal explanation of it was all just crisis actors. It didn't really happen. It was just a Hollywood production. And I understand why people can go that far because they see Hollywood productions, and they see what the Jews are capable of putting up on the screen, you know, that they can actually manufacture things that look real. But to me, that's not necessary. I don't even need to dig into the details of 9/11. By the time people told me I should look into 9/11, I was well past that. I already understood I understood race, and I understand the Jews are the enemy. So once you understand that, I think that's really what the important thing is. These other things, 9/11, the Holocaust, all the details of the Holocaust, and arguing that amongst each other, men's rights, counter jihad, all of that stuff just becomes kind of peripheral once you realize that race is real, the white race is what's important to you, and the Jews are the biggest enemy of that. Then, yeah, you could say that the Jews are capable of just about anything. Do the mm-hmm. Jews give the commands to our government? Sure, Jews rule. I mean, if not directly, you know, occupying the office of the president, they are the ones who narrate our imaginations. They using the control of the media, they put the ideas in our heads as to what is good and what is bad. And with that power, it's like the power to print money. It's just there's infinite, almost infinite spillover from that into other things. I want to say, though, that it's not infinite. The Jews do not have infinite control. And that's what makes me skeptical about elaborate things like 9/11 or some of these other things that people, you know, say are just hoaxes entirely. And even when they say the Holocaust was a hoax, or the hollow hoax, it's the Germans had camps. They put Jews in those camps. They distinguished Jews from themselves racially, biologically. That is real. The hoax part is the soap and the lampshades and the 6 million and the exaggerations that the Jews tell about it. But it goes deeper than just the Holocaust even. It's questioning the Jews on any aspect of the history. Take, you know, disagreeing with the Jews about the fact that they're victims historically. That's as bad as Holocaust denial. It's maybe doesn't have a word for it other than anti-Semitism, anything more specific than that. But that is really what you need to do, is realize that the whole thing is a lie, not just the Holocaust, but their whole history from their point of view is a lie. It's and this is another point to make, is history itself is a story from a certain point of view. People like to describe history as having an objective basis in reality, and yes, there are facts upon which a given history is based. The events happen. But even when you have something that happened recently, if you have two people involved and you get both of their stories, you're going to get two different versions of what happened. Which one is true? It's hard to tell. You know, and even you, in standing outside of it, listening to both sides, you create a third opinion, a third view of what happened. I'm not trying to say that it's all relative, but it's more relative, I think, than most people give credit to. Okay. I'm a rational, logical person. I believe in reality-based. I believe in science. I'm grounded in that way, and I'm skeptical of arguments based on just hand waving and assertion. You know, saying mm-hmm. you know you got to believe this, otherwise you're stupid. And that's one of the things that's kind of left a bad taste in my mouth about 9/11 is when people come and make an argument like that to me. Say, oh, you believe that 12 Arabs or 19 Arabs did 9/11? You've got to be an idiot. Actually, I don't know. And right. I know I don't trust my government. I know I think my government answers to Jews and serves Jews more than it serves its own citizenry. I know that that's a fraud. I know, you know, Boaz was a fraud. You know, what more do you need to know other than Jews are the enemy? Why dig in to the details? Now, I don't.
Okay, that's fair enough. I understand where you're coming from.
I'm not opposed to the people who want to spend their life digging into the details of 9/11 or the Holocaust or any of the other aspects. That research is valuable because then you can, like McDonald's books, you can point at it. You can say, okay, I can build from there. I can stand on the shoulders of those giants and I can do something beyond that, something meta, taking their results and all the detailed arguments that they've laid out and going beyond it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. That's fair enough. I have a much clearer perspective of where you're coming from on these issues. So thanks for clarifying all that. And, you know, I totally hear what you're saying. It's a good argument. Although, you know, obviously I'd probably disagree slightly. Now, to wrap up here, I just wanted to get your take on Trump, on Donald Trump especially, and just the presidential campaign in general. I've been, frankly, very impressed with Donald Trump. I'm not trying to say he's like some white nationalist or anything like that, but I think he's saying a lot of very important things, and I do find him to be a genuine person, and I think he's running a brilliant campaign. So what's your take?
He's definitely creating an earthquake and or several earthquakes, a daily earthquake from, you know, what did Trump do today to turn things upside down? And in that respect, it's good. I think, first of all, though, it's Trump is an example, a physical example of how the Jews infiltrate, how they intermarry with the non-Jewish elite and form alliances with them. And together that how this goes forward, you know, Trump, as unlikely as he is to say, I'm a proud white man and I'm going to do what's best for white people. He does say things that come very close to that about Jews, how he'd be a good president for Jews because he'd, you know, defend Israel 1,000%, all of that stuff. So, you know, he's a good example of how the Jews, how Jewish influence actually works. But I think the on the flip side, on the good side, for Trump is that he exposes this Judeo-liberal democracy for the fraud that it is. That, you know, basically it's pretty obvious that the people behind the curtains are Jews because of the way that Trump is so obsequious to Jews and Israel, but also how they react, how Jews are very, very much in trying to incite fear and loathing of Trump, how they, you know, compare him to Hitler, even though the comparison is laughable. In their minds, it's real. You know, that's a measure of how hypersensitive they are, how the old joke about, you know, your broken leg is a comedy and my hangnail is a tragedy. Everything is a tragedy, another Holocaust about to happen from a Jewish point of view. That's part of the secret of their success. They don't let any detail slide. And when it comes to Trump, they did the same thing with Obama. They complained that he was a horrible anti-Semite and every little thing he did that they didn't like, Obama is a horrible anti-Semite. So this is becoming, I think, more obvious to more whites more quickly than it ever has in the past. And Trump is, he's not doing it on purpose. I think the way I understand Trump is that he is just a pragmatist. He wants to be president and he knows that all he has to do is say things that are popular, and he doesn't care. Other candidates wouldn't say those things. They know what is popular too. They know that shutting down the border, building a wall, deporting them all of that stuff, make America great again. They try to mimic him to the extent that they can, but they all answer directly to Jewish donors, the Jewish donor class that funds their campaigns and who would destroy them in the media if they were to say those things that Trump is saying. Well, Trump is saying it, and the media is trying to destroy him, the Jewish media, but he's using Twitter and Facebook to go directly to the people. It's the first candidate who's really done that himself. I mean, the candidates have in the past had those social media accounts, but Trump actually communicates mostly that way. And most of the Jews media tearing down to him is reacting to what he's doing.
Yeah, and that's what I mean by, you know, he's running a very effective campaign and, you know, that he's genuine because he is himself out there, you know, operating his own Twitter account And, you know, he speaks very well in front of crowds, I think. You know, again, the issues that he's bringing up are very important and resonating very deeply with sort of, you know, most of America. I mean, I think a lot of his views on the border, for example, are mainstream amongst many Americans.
And even many non-whites. He's actually more popular with non-whites than the media. That was one of the things they tried on him first is, oh, no, you know, he said this horrible stuff about Mexican immigrants. And that's it. He's lost the Mexican vote. You know, the assumption being that Mexicans vote as a block, that all these and they all vote pro immigration. And the reality is different than that. It's and Trump has demonstrated that. Mm-hmm. I think the other main point about Trump, though, to keep in mind is that we've seen this pattern before. In fact, it's been the pattern of white politicians for 100 years, at least the last 50. Where they promise things like Nixon did with his silent majority quote. That was the thing that the dispossessed minority or majority that we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. Nixon talked about the silent majority, and he talked in private with Billy Graham about that it was the Jews that were the enemy and attacking him, although he didn't seem to really fully appreciate just how much of an enemy they were, how implacable they were.
Right,
but we've seen it with Schwarzenegger in California. You should be familiar with that. Maggie Thatcher in Britain did it. You know, they dog whistle on race. That's what the left calls it, dog whistling. This saying things in code like Trump does that are popular and that they know are popular. But then when they get into office, they don't actually deliver. They do the opposite. In fact, in a lot of cases, like Thatcher did, or like Reagan did, or Nixon. Trump would be a change from the norm if he were to get into office and actually try to do what he's said he's going to do, building a wall and everything. And even though he said he's going to build a wall, he also says he's going to have a great big door in it. And that's evidence that Trump understands that he can say whatever he wants to get elected. He tells one group of people, I'm going to build a giant wall. And then for the benefit of the other people who are skeptics or don't want to hear that, he says, I'm going to have a big fat door in it. And, you know, he's trusting that people are too stupid to put those two together and see that they contradict each other.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, I don't think it is stupidity. I think it's just people, they want to hear, they want leadership. They're certainly white people are just thirsty for somebody to push back against this smothering downward spiral that, you know, even if they don't think in terms of race, they think in terms of their country, that their country is going to hell and they want to take their country back. Oftentimes, they don't think any farther than that. They don't think to themselves, take it back from who? From the Mexicans? It's not the Mexicans who let themselves in here. They don't want to confront the fact that it's race and that it's the Jews that are the enemy. And on Trump, the ones who are cheering for Trump, at least half of them are in that camp, that they are cheering for Trump because he's saying things that they want to hear, but they aren't thinking beyond that to, you know, can I really believe this guy? Is he really going to do what he's saying? He says he loves Israel, and he loves Jews. His daughter is married to one. He does business with them. Can I really trust him to fight the enemy?
Yeah, no, those are all good points and, you know, very well taken. I think, you know, we'd be fools just to simply assume that Trump is going to get in there and do everything that he's now saying. And as you mentioned with, you know, his comments about, you know, he wants to have a big door to let people in through the border are, you know, a little bit troublesome. But yeah, I mean, I think we should definitely hold his feet to the fire as best we can. And what my strategy has always been, you know, as soon as he sort of got into the campaign was to really try to reach out to his supporters, the people who were paying attention to Trump, your, you know, Tea Party types, your traditional conservatives and you know, old time Republicans, and to sort of draw them into our camp, into the race realist camp, into the quote unquote anti-Semitic camp, which really, mm-hmm. as we talked about, is just being honest about Jews. And you know, maybe that's been effective to a certain degree, maybe not, I don't know. But I really think that we have the potential to reach out and get more and more people into, you know, our way of thinking as a result of what Donald Trump is doing with this campaign.
Yeah, and it only takes a little bit of nudging because the evidence is right there for people to see. if they see it in the right way. They can see, for instance, that for the last several election cycles, whites have been psychopathologized by the Jewish media, that disliking and distrusting Obama is just a sign of that whites are racist, and not voting for Obama is you're a racist just because you're white. You don't even have to say that it's because you're white. The Tea Partiers are a good example of that, where they formed and the Jewish media psychopathologizes them for being racist when they bend over backwards to demonstrate that they're not racist. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you have Jews openly expressing their dislike for Obama, even though they ended up voting for him, then their distrust for him. And they're doing the same thing with Trump this time around. And the narrative for that is that, well, this is just Jews looking out for what's best for the Jews. It makes sense.
Right. And
to me, that's one of the things that you can point to your mom or pop or neighbor next door as something that's very obvious, that Jews are not white. They're not treated to the same standard politically as whites. The Jews can organize like any non-white group for their own best interest, do it openly, and there's no problem. In fact, the problem only starts if you say that there's something wrong with it, then you're a racist hater. Meanwhile, whites
can't Yeah.
Whites, just the rumor of whites starting white student unions is this unthinkable disaster from the Jewish media's point of view. They can't stand the idea that whites might actually organize, even if it's just a rumor. And I don't think it is just a rumor. I think there is actually a nugget, a growing awareness that whites are having that this is not going well, and it's because they're white and that they're going to have to face this at some point or another. The Jew thing, I think, will come after that. For some people, the Jew thing comes first, and then they discover whiteness. I think it depends, just mm-hmm. how.
Right. And obviously, both of them are interrelated and connected and very, easy to piece together once you start thinking about these things.
Right. The opposite of what Jared Taylor says, that they're two separate things. They are interrelated to each other.
Right, and anybody being honest should recognize that. Hey, Tanstoffel, we are going to go ahead and wrap up now. This has been a very, interesting discussion for sure, and I just want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to join me here today.
Well, I thank you, John, for having me on. You're very knowledgeable. You understand things very well, and you articulate yourself very well. You put it very well. Whenever I hear you speak about these issues, I'm always impressed.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. That certainly means a lot coming from you, because I've learned quite a bit over the years from reading your site and listening to your radio program. So I really do appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Dan, and thanks everybody for...
Nieuw op Disney Plus. Gruwelijke spanning in het allerlaatste seizoen van The Walking Dead.
These people, they want stuff.
IJzingwekkende sensatie in de veelbelovende nieuwe serie Why the Last Man.
In one day, half of our world gone.
En een flinke portie humor met Selena Gomez in Only Murders in the Building.
I wanna break into a dead guy's apartment.
Stream nu exclusief op Disney+.
Sounds like an afternoon.